This is the Deep Side of Dallas. I'm Rudy Bush, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Dallas Morning News.
And I'm Paul Corliss, Chief Communications Officer for the University of North Texas System. Dallas and the communities around us are changing. We're here to talk about our history, our future, and where we are today.
On the Deep Side, we dive into local news and issues through candid conversations with people making an impact in Dallas and beyond. And you can stay up to date on every episode and other great shows from our newsroom. Just follow the Dallas Morning News wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to the Deep Side of Dallas podcast. I'm Paul Corliss, Chief Communications Officer for the University of North Texas System, here with Rudy Bush from the Dallas Morning News. And Rudy, it's Pride Month, and all over the country, the LGBTQ community is being celebrated. And while people may not know the name Mark Ferris everywhere in the country, in Texas, this is going to be a name that has a historic court decision attached to it.
It will, and Mark Ferris and his husband Vic Holmes' names will be part of Texas history. But the reason I was glad we had Mark in, Paul, is because what I really want to know is the personal story behind these names and what it meant to this man and the man he loves and the man he's married to deal with a life where they weren't accepted and where they struggled. And as he tells us in this podcast, from the time he was a very young boy, he denied himself. He had thoughts of self-harm.
Yeah.
All of the things that go into the struggle that a lot of this month is about. So I thought it was a great conversation. I'm glad we were able to have it.
No, I went home and talked to my family about it a little bit, because it moved me when he said, you know, as a young guy, he is going to bed and praying that he'll wake up different or not wake up at all.
Yeah.
And that just moved me.
Not wake up at all. And that's, I think people who think about these issues ought to listen to what Mark Ferris has to say about the life he lived as a child and the life he has now as a man.
So without further ado, we'll take a quick break and be back with Mark Ferris as part of our discussion for Pride Month.
At the University of North Texas System, we embrace the future. Energized by new possibilities, we collaborate across institutions, disciplines, and industries to creatively imagine and implement solutions in our home region of Dallas-Fort Worth and beyond. Our institutions have embraced tomorrow, becoming stronger in community leadership, use of technology, collaborative partnerships, and service to our students, faculty, and staff. Whether in Dallas, Denton, Fort Worth, or Frisco, throughout North Texas, across our state and beyond, the UNT system is fully committed to being a leader for the North Texas region. With our heart in North Texas, we transform lives and create economic opportunity through education.
Welcome back to the Deep Side of Dallas podcast. I'm Paul Corliss, Chief Communications Officer for the University of North Texas System, here with my co-host Rudy Bush of the Dallas Morning News. Today's podcast guest had the courage to take on the state of Texas, challenging a ban on same-sex marriage with a lawsuit filed in 2014. Mark Ferris, a Plano-based attorney, wasn't completely out of the closet at the time he and his partner filed suit, but doing what he believed was right outweighed any fears, and eventually a federal judge ruled in their favor, ushering in change to the state of Texas. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Mark, thanks. We really appreciate you being here, especially being here during Pride Month. It's an important time to think about and reflect on your journey and the journey of so many people in the LGBTQ community. And I'm really interested just to start off by getting you to talk about your life process of discovering your sexuality, understanding your sexuality, and recognizing that it wasn't a sexuality that was going to be accepted really in the time that you and I grew up. So just talk about that. What was that like as a boy and then as a young man and then coming into the fullness of who you are?
Well, that's a good question, Rudy. Thank you. When I was born in 1960, there was no marriage equality. There were no job protections for the LGBTQ community. You would be discharged from the military. There was, and in fact, if you were in a gay bar, you were very likely at risk of being arrested, which is what prompted the Stonewall riots 52 years ago. So for me, I always knew I was different. At some point, I put a word to it that I was gay, that I liked guys. And, you know, I would, at nights, I would frequently pray. When I'd go to sleep, I'd pray for God to make me straight or take me in my sleep. I didn't want to wake up the next morning, so it was, you know, and of course I'd wake up the next morning and still liked guys, you know, so it was something I tried to suppress. And, you know, it all of my fears made sense. You know, as a 17-year-old in 1977, Anita Bryant, who's former Miss Oklahoman, fought an effort in Miami-Dade County to reverse a non-discrimination ordinance that would prohibit discrimination against gays in employment, public accommodations, and housing. You know, God forbid, gays can't have jobs and housing and eat. And so that was reversed on a 2-to-1 basis.
Were you aware of that as a young man?
Absolutely, I was aware.
Okay.
Absolutely, I was aware. And then Oklahoma legislature subsequently was empowered and passed a law prohibiting gays from even being teachers. And you couldn't advocate. Straight or gay individual as a teacher could not advocate for homosexuality. And you couldn't say anything positive or that's a fireable offense under that statute. So I saw that and I thought, my gosh, you know, I'm going to be abandoned. If someone finds out I'm gay, I'll be abandoned. I'll be jobless. I'll be homeless. I'll go hungry. You know, the consequences for me as someone who was a debater and extemporaneous speaker who stayed up on all kinds of, you know, current affairs, I knew all about that, and it scared me to death. So I did everything I knew to suppress that. I, you know, dated women in college, and then, you know, I dated a woman for seven years. She's a wonderful person, love her to death, but I knew I couldn't marry her. That would have been unfair to her and unfair to me and a disaster.
And during that period of time, were you sort of in an internal struggle still as to could you sort of convert yourself, for lack of a better word, or was that your, what was your thinking on that?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I would admit it that I was gay until something like I was 32 or 34 years old. I would, you know, the first time I went to a gay bar, you know, I'd looked around and thought, oh my God, look at all these gay people. And you know, you start kind of realizing that there are others out there. Growing up in a lot in Oklahoma, I didn't know of anyone. So that was kind of my process. I eventually, you know, started dating some guys. Eventually met Vic at a birthday party and fell in love. You know, all good things came from that. But that process, I mean, there were very many nights where, you know, I had a neighbor. I had a guy over to my house one time, and my neighbor left a voicemail message. I don't know which neighbor, although I suspect, when I lived in San Antonio, saying, you know, I was going to hell. Don't choose hell. You know, choose God, choose life. Yeah, it was an awful, awful message.
A break in a point in time where you said to yourself, "To hell with this, I'm done with all that," or you know, did you work to a point where you could be a little more open? And I'm just interested in that process of discovery.
For you. So it's not like you snap your fingers and embrace. You're in an interpersonal struggle.
Right. Well, I really didn't tell my office. Until much later, and told a couple people at my office. One, I told a coworker who I was very good friends with, that babysat his kids, you know, and he told me not to tell his wife, you know, and asked me if I needed to go get counseling and wanted to know if I was a pedophile. That was the first coworker I told.
Wow.
So that experience wasn't very good. And you know, I ultimately told my sister and my brother when I was with Vic, and I decided I'm not going to spend Christmas apart. And that first Christmas didn't go very well. My twin sister actually, I was 38, and of course she's 38, and basically, we had to, after arriving at the house, driving 8 hours to get there in Oklahoma from San Antonio in a snowstorm, bringing all kinds of presents, we had to load back up and go to a hotel. And we really don't have a relationship since. She didn't attend our wedding, didn't send a card, you know, that kind of thing.
So and emotionally, there's so many challenges you've laid out, right? That's just painful, you know. You're having hate messages left on your voicemail. Your family is not embracing things. You're struggling internally. I just can't put myself through all of that emotion that you must have had to be a successful attorney and have had all those struggles. Has to be you overcame a lot.
And I think that's what's so interesting too about this conversation is people who are straight maybe and don't understand any portion of this kind of experience.
Well, yeah. I mean, the one thing fortunately, first of all, my brother was accepting, and some cousins of mine were accepting. So, you know, as I start telling some family members, most of them were accepting my twin sister not being one. Mm-hmm. I've come to the point that everyone. I mean, I definitely, you know, everyone who goes through junior high and high school, we all have angst. You know, everyone has some kind of angst of some kind of sort, and you know, and I certainly had that. And mine is different than others. Maybe on it's added to the normal angst. So I try to think of myself as just what I went through is just different than what other people go through.
And your husband, Vic Holmes, he was in the military, right? With the don't ask, don't tell era of the military.
Correct.
What was his experience like?
Well, yeah, I mean, his was he joined the military right out of high school as the lowest level that you could be. And, of course, when he initially joined, there wasn't even don't ask, don't tell. It was you're not allowed.
Yeah.
So, you know, he kept that completely buttoned up. And then there was don't ask, don't tell, but that really didn't. There was actually more pursuit of the LGBTQ community under don't ask, don't tell than there was before, which is kind of interesting.
Well, that is interesting, yeah.
So he hit it, we hit it. You know, he eventually moved in with me. Literally, I had him sign a lease that said he got the second bedroom. He literally paid me rent, which, you know, I would somehow or another indirectly get back to him. But you had to have all these ways of evidencing that we really weren't a couple. And we actually came up with, to tell each other that we loved each other, we had to come up with code words. Because you couldn't say that. You couldn't text that. If someone saw your phone and saw that, that would be problematic. So, for example, on 9/11, he was stationed at that time in Mississippi, Biloxi, Mississippi, and was called in to the base, and we thought he was going to be sent overseas. We had no idea what he was going to do. He had to just pack, and they didn't know. And he had to step outside to call me to try to tell me he loved me. And, you know, and of course we knew that we can't send letters that say I love you or text or an email. And we did have code, and the code would be, you know, what is the garage door opener, you know, number again? I can't remember. Oh, it's **131. Ah, that's right, **131. So that was our code for saying we love you. You know, but that was, you know, until, and ironically, he retired in December of 2010 and put in his note. You have to put in your notice about a year in advance. And so he put in the notice, and in December of 2010 is when Obama signed legislation repealing don't ask, don't tell, and you could serve openly. But he didn't know that at the time, and, you know, by then he's already on his way out. So, but anyway.
I want to get into this question that opened at the beginning, because I imagine you talk to younger gay men and lesbian women about their experiences, but I want to get there by first talking about the fact that they might have different experiences because you and Vic put yourselves on the line in a very public way in 2013 when you all decided to really be the lead plaintiffs, if that's the correct term, in a suit to overturn the outlawing of same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. So tell us how you all came to the decision to, from what was really a very private and secret life from the time you were very young through your love for each other, your early love for each other, to be this very public couple that is the face, really, of a lawsuit.
Well, primarily we chose to because we loved each other. We'd been together. Now I'm going to have, I'd have to do math. I think by the time the decision came down, 18 years. We're getting ready to celebrate our 23rd year together in August. And so I think we just finally, we wanted to marry the person we loved in the state we loved. And we were incensed by the injustice. So I think that that's primarily what drove it. You know, when the Windsor decision came down in June of 2013, I read that decision the day it came down and thought, you know, if it's illegal, unconstitutional for the federal government to discriminate, then surely it's unconstitutional for the states. And a friend of mine...
Yeah, Frank, maybe tell people what Windsor is quickly for those who
yeah,
are listening.
The Windsor decision is U.S. versus Windsor. Is a decision that the Supreme Court issued in June of 2013 that said that it was a violation of the Due Process and Equal Protection Clause for the federal government not to recognize a marriage that was recognized by a state. So they're in New York, their marriage from Canada was recognized in New York, and the Windsor decision said, you federal government can't discriminate. So I read that and I think, well, it's you know, the same clauses. It's impossible that the state's going to be able to discriminate. And coincidentally, a friend of mine, Frank Stinger, who was at the time the assistant general counsel for the law firm of Ank & Gump, called me and we were talking about it. And he said, we need to find some plaintiffs. And I said, no, we need to find a law firm who will take on this case. And he said, well, I wonder if my law firm would. So short and sweet, he went back to his law firm and asked, and they were more than happy to. And he called me back up 2 weeks later on a Monday and said, I have good news for you. The law firm's willing to take this case, but now we need plaintiffs. And we would really like some plaintiffs where one of them is, or one or both are veterans. And I sort of thought he's asking, since Vic's a veteran, asking us if we would be plaintiffs. Well, of course, you know, I'm not going to commit to anything like that without first talking to Vic. So I said, well, let me think of some names for you, but I'll call you back tomorrow. So anyway, I talked to Vic that night, and we decided that we would do it. And so I called him the next day and said that we would be the plaintiffs. And then we were joined a month or two later. This was July of 2013. A month later, as we talked for other plaintiffs, then we found another couple out of Austin, Cleo and Nicole, who had already been married in another state and were willing to, and one of them was also a veteran, who would join the lawsuit and seek recognition of theirs. So we were seeking the right to get married, and they were seeking recognition of their out-of-state marriage. So it was kind of a two-pronged case, and the recognition was probably an easier case than the right to get married. Ultimately, you know, even Obergefell, by the way, was a recognition. Obergefell, the individual, had been married in Maryland and was seeking recognition of his marriage. There were other plaintiffs who were seeking the right to get married.
Right.
So anyway.
And for those listening, Obergefell was the named plaintiff in the famous Supreme Court case, which
exactly
ultimately legalized same-sex marriage.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I sometimes assume everyone knows what I'm talking about, so thank you for...
Well, that's a famous case, but I don't know if it's as well known as maybe it could be or it will be. It feels like it's going to be, you know, it's a landmark.
Yeah.
Supreme Court
case.
A brand
name, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah. So when you guys are making the decision to file suit, did you anticipate it being such a public situation? Because it sounds like it was just a media onslaught.
Right. No, we didn't. In fact, we talked to the lawyers, and the lawyers said they would handle all the publicity. And so, you know, I took everything we could take off of anything, you know, from LinkedIn to my bar to Facebook, et cetera, so that no one could figure out how to reach me. I tried to do, and Vic tried to do, and, you know, and then I'm no more than sitting at my office than the phone rang, and it's may have been the Dallas Morning News,
and
thinking, how do they know how to get me? You know, how did they find my cell phone number? And I'm getting...
We have our ways.
You must. And so I was so worked up about that. Literally, I was, there wasn't job protection at that time. So I literally could have been fired at my job with that, you know, I being out. And, you know, even the... a listing of the plaintiffs, I suggested that we do it alphabetically and the two couples. I suggested we list our names alphabetically, which coincidentally had my name last. that was done on purpose. So all of a sudden now it's not so private. And, you know, one of my fears was losing my job. Luckily that didn't happen. One of my fears was, losing some friends. I did lose a friend, a friend of mine who I would bet on the OU-Texas game every year, basically quit being my friend as a result. Sent me a text and said the lawsuit bothered him. I was also worried about, you know, any kind of death threats. We did get some, and we had to take precautions.
And that's what you said at the time. You all did have serious and legitimate fears for your safety.
We did. Yeah, we did. And, I mean, we would hire a dog sitter just to come and bring our dogs in the house when there was, you know, heightened publicity to keep our dogs in because we were afraid someone might, you know, do something to our dogs.
Yeah.
So, luckily none of that transpired. But, you know, it only takes one. So we were very nervous about that.
Did you feel compelled to be a trailblazer? Did you think, or did you just want to be together under under marriage? You know, officially married. Were you compelled to blaze a trail for others, or was it just that you guys wanted to be married?
Well, it was a little of both. I mean, we knew we primarily did it because we wanted to marry, but we also knew that that would allow others to marry, and so we, you know. That was another reason why I was so nervous at the time, because, you know, I didn't want to say anything. You know, you're getting interviewed. You don't want to say something. I'm a lawyer, so I'm naturally going to worry. Am I going to say something that's going to undermine my lawsuit? I don't know whether there are going to be depositions. There weren't. There were in other cases, but there weren't in our case. Are there going to be depositions? What is the thing I need to say? What do I need to not say? What do I need to not talk about? So there was that. Also, you know, we know we're kind of representing the LGBTQ community, and we want to put our best foot forward. So as a result, for 2 years, I didn't speed, which is, it's kind of funny, but I don't even want to get pulled over and get a ticket.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it's just an interesting dynamic. But, we were thrilled to do it.
One of the things that is interesting to me about, as I reflect on my own thinking around Obergefell and the journey towards marriage equality that the country has gone through, in 2014, I wrote a column about how I saw gay people treated as when I was growing up in Alabama, and the sort of open prejudice and hostility, and when I was a kid, high school kids would go throw beer bottles at men coming out of the one t- town's gay bar, and that was just that was kicks, you know. And from Obergefell in 2014 to where we, and I was it 2014 or 2015?
The decision was 2015.
2015, excuse me. 2015. Thank you for correcting me. To where we are today, from my seat, it seems like we have had a real sea change in society's understanding of how to treat people fairly. Now, maybe that's rose-colored glasses on my part, but I am wondering what your perspective is. I mean, once that door opened, did it really change the hearts and minds of American people, or am I imagining that?
No, I think, well, the first blessing of the decision was that I got to marry the person I love.
Yeah.
So that was, and so did hundreds of thousands of other couples get to marry. So that was a plus. It also, there is a very distinct tie, link between government action and the how individuals feel about themselves, how the LGBTQ community feels about themselves. And with that decision, it was a sense of acceptance that we finally are, to some extent, fully citizens. And so, you know, Vic and I, when we were at the airport waiting for the decision, we were at Southwest Airport at Love Field, waiting to get on Southwest to go to Austin. We kept waiting for they don't tell you when the decision's going to come down. So every day that there was going to be an announcement, we would sit there at Love Field and wait. And if the decision didn't come down that day, we'd then turn in our tickets and go back home. So eventually the decision was issued. And it was the oddest reaction, frankly, from Vic and me. You would think it would be, and it was somewhat celebratory, but we, you know, when it hit us, we're sitting there in this little cafe reading, and we're getting ready to get our stuff together and go through security and walk, and we're bawling. And I'm not a crier, and it we're just bawling that, I mean, we just can't believe that we can now finally marry and that we're treated equally. And I mean, it's just such, it was such a, it is almost impossible to describe. But, and thankfully the security people, I think thought we'd had a death in the family, so they let us go through security very quickly. But it was really kind of, I mean, it was very joyous, obviously, but it, you know, it was something that we, in our entire lifetime, thought we'd never see.
Rudy had talked about kind of changing societal norms and treatment of the LGBTQ community. I was curious, how would you say Dallas is compared to other cities? You know, I think of Dallas as probably the most progressive city in Texas, but Texas probably not the most progressive state in the union. So I'm curious, in your travels, where would you feel most comfortable, and where does Dallas compare in there? Curious about that.
Well, I think Dallas is progressive on LGBTQ issues. I in general feel, I think the Dallas and Austin and Houston, certainly in certain areas in all three of those cities, you're fine. Probably in certain areas of those, you probably wouldn't be. But, you know, I'm still, Vic and I would never and do not, when we go on walks, we would never hold hands. That would be
really
a prescription for being shot, we would think, or something. And even today, you know, if I'm in the car and Vic's and we're holding hands and a truck drives up next to us and, you know, they're tall enough and they can, even if they can't, if I think they can see in and see we're holding hands, I will let go of his hand just because I don't want, you know, I don't want to get shot. And so, you know, and constitutional carry, permitless carry is probably not going to make me feel more secure. So You know, I mean, I certainly feel, you know, welcome in Dallas. Dallas has a great LGBTQ community. It's actually probably one of the best communities that provides funding for LGBTQ causes. I mean, there's probably not, if it's not the best city, it's certainly in the top. So, you know, I think Dallas is very exciting, but, you know, there's still a long ways, there's still a long ways to go. I mean, we've got a legislature that just proposed 30 anti-LGBTQ laws and 13 of which targeted trans youth. You know, I think we clearly have improved. They can get married, they can serve in the military, their job protections now because of a Supreme Court decision last year, a Bostick decision, under Title VII now provides job protection at least with employers that have 15 or more employees. You're not going to get arrested going into a gay bar like you might have in my day. So, I mean, things have progressed, but, you know, again, as I indicated earlier, government action, negative action, affects people, and what they're doing with, particularly with trans youth, affects them. And already, you know, something like 41% of trans youth, according to the Trevor Project, contemplate suicide, and 48% of those will actually attempt it. So that's about 20% attempt suicide. That's huge. And the way you reduce that is to recognize that they're real people with real feelings, and they may be different than you, but that doesn't mean that they're not entitled to all the equal rights of citizenship that comes with the state of Texas. You know, I'm disappointed with our legislature in that regard.
I was going to ask you about that because obviously you got into politics, you ran, you Angela Paxton, mm-hmm. who is the wife of the Attorney General, won the seat. You were the Democrat, right? Mm-hmm. She was the correct. Republican. What was your experience of how your sexuality was used against you, if it was in that race? I mean, how much of an issue was it to be a gay man in that race, which was not very long ago, years ago?
Yeah, 2018. No, it wasn't that long ago. You know, it was by and large, from my perspective. Now, my campaign manager says he hid some of the stuff from me. From my perspective, it wasn't that much of an issue. Now, I do know that Angela Paxton at one time tried to make it an issue and suggested at some event that they shouldn't send a senator to the Texas Senate. Of course, I made a joke that from there on out, every campaign appearance I made a joke that, listen, I'll take all the center votes and she can have the non-center votes. You know? So,
you'd certainly be the first center in the Senate.
Exactly. So it was my experience was in both the lawsuit and in my run was that Texans hearts and their minds are as big as Texas. There are exceptions, but when we traveled around the lawsuit and when I campaigned, no one cared that I was gay. What they cared about was, what did I want to do for public schools? What did I want to do for transportation? What did I want to do for job creation? That's what they all cared about. They didn't care that I was gay. And I've always joked, even though I didn't go to Oklahoma undergrad or law school, I've rooted for their football program forever. And so I've always said that
we'll forgive you.
I always thought Texans would and voters would care more that I was an OU fan than that I was gay. So
interesting perspective.
That is a sin.
As we kind of wind up our conversation, I want to see if I can frame this up properly. So we started our discussion and we talked about your youth and the struggles of trying to suppress, mm-hmm. and you know, then going through the coming out process, and some people embrace and some people turn their back on you. As you reach later life, I mean, I find myself trying to figure out what is my legacy to leave behind, right? And do you feel like the lawsuit is a legacy, and that everything you struggled and went through to get you to that point, that's sort of the legacy you leave behind?
Yes. I mean, I certainly think, I can't imagine my obit is not going to mention that lawsuit. So I definitely think that that's a legacy, and it's certainly one I'm very proud of. You know, I also think that, you know, what I went through helped with that. But I'll also say, even without that lawsuit, it helped me. Yeah, and I know that's an odd saying, but I think it made me a better person. It made me more open-minded towards people who suffer, who go through different experiences than I do. And I just think it makes me want to walk a little bit in other people's shoes first before I start throwing too many stones. So that's, for me, it maybe didn't feel like it at the time, but I think it's been a blessing in disguise.
I wanted to sort of finish where we started, which is to get you to talk about what young gay men and women tell you about their experiences, and whether you think that things have gotten better, whether you think young people today don't have to suffer in the way that you suffered, or is it a different experience that you're having when you talk to them?
You know, I think they have some of the same issues. You know, you still have to, even if you've got job protection, that doesn't do sometimes a lot of good if you've lost your job. You know, so I think that they, you know, they still wrestle sometimes with whether or not they should come out at the office. You know, I've had those discussions with them, and I'm far be it from me to tell anyone when they need to come out and when they don't, and to whom they need to come out to and who they shouldn't. So, you know, I think they wrestle with the same thing, but I think the spirit of pride is to celebrate who we are, and in all of our diversity. And I hope that that's the principal reason to keep the pride marches and the pride months that have started since 1970, that after the Stonewall riots, that the year after, that we need to keep that so that everyone, whoever is that little Mark Ferris sitting there wondering, are there other gay people out there, is it okay, etc., that the pride lets them know that it is okay, and so whenever they're ready, they can then come out.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us and being so open and sharing your story, and best of luck to you and Vic moving forward. And to our audience, thank you for listening to The Deep Side of Dallas. Feel free to email us at deepside@dallasnews.com with questions, comments, and ideas. For Rudy Bush, I'm Paul Corliss. We'll talk to you soon. The Deep Side of Dallas is presented by the Dallas Morning News and the University of North Texas System. Our show is produced by Aiden Barrett.
If you like what you heard today, please follow the Dallas Morning News wherever you get your podcasts. You'll also get our daily news roundup and special audio reports. And if you have questions, comments, or guest ideas, we want to hear from you. Just email us at deepside@dallasnews.com. Until next time, I'm Rudy Bush.
And I'm Paul Corliss. Thanks for listening.